This week on Making Contact.
Like, you really don't realize how much power you have, like how much power your voice has, until you actually get out there and do something.
Self-expression is a powerful tool and a healthy method to dealing with everyday challenges we face in our life.
Art is everywhere, from ancient cave paintings to metropolitan opera houses. But why do we do it? Why do we create symbols of our cultural experience and labor to tell the world who we are through artistic expressions? On this edition, we speak with young artists of diverse backgrounds and motivations who use their independent experiences and creative impulses to talk about race, identity, and politics, and along the way, to self-reflect. I'm Tina Rubio, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
Raised by the Department of Corrections. Do you mind if I take you on a journey with me through my life? Each piece that I have written was conformed first by a current event that has taken place in America. I write for the revolutionary voices that have went silent over the years for my generation and foreparents' lack of listening.
Hear me out.
And I moan out for the voices that lay dormant inside of us all.
Thank you, Julius.
I speak from experience and deliverance from the dark corners of my solitude I call my mind. I declare to you this day that I speak with the intent to deliver a message most needed in our community.
Life has purpose.
I do not write out of vain nor for self-gratification. I have chosen this season in my life.
That's a poetry clip written and produced by Angelina Jackson, an African-American poet and spoken word artist who grew up on the streets of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She joined us on the phone from Columbus, Ohio. Angelina, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tina, for having me.
Your poetry CD, Before You Go, Hear Me Out. In that first clip we just heard, you start by telling us that you want to take us on a journey, and we're talking about your life's journey that you want to share. So can you start by telling us where you grew up and tell us what was going on in your life and community at that time?
Sure. Well, I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The neighborhood that I grew up in, it was infested with drugs. So I grew up during a time where they were fighting over drug territory. And that's when back they was publicizing about pimps and prostitutes, and stealing was cool. And, you know, we was drinking and smoking weed and experimenting with other drugs. So I grew up in a time in my community when drugs had really riddled the family unity. By 1999, I had an armed robbery. I was 20 years old, and I was charged and convicted. I was given 15 years in Chiquita Correctional Institution in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, for women. So at the time when I began my writings, I was in prison. I was in my early 20s, and I was really angry and frustrated about what I had endured in my life, because I was a teenage prostitute. I was a teenage drug dealer, as well as a teenage addict. So I had a lot of shameful memories and emotions trapped inside of me that I had never shared with anyone, and it left me pretty volatile. So I had an anger issue at that time as well. So I used writing as a means to express some of my most deepest and hidden dark secrets and feelings.
Let's listen to this next clip about a secret you wrote while you were incarcerated and are just now sharing.
Mama, what happened to lullabies? At age 12, you had me in bars hustling older guys. You didn't blink an eye when I left junior high, so why do you cry now that I have to struggle to stay alive? I remember you telling me to be all that I could be. You taught me the game and said if I wasn't your daughter, you would pimp me. Don't you see? I'm a product of your inability to raise me, praise me. It was your job to save your baby. Men have beaten, raped, and degraded me, but the times I cried is for the way you neglected me, disrespected me, and told me I wasn't cold-hearted enough to be mama's baby. You and you alone could have saved me. When will you realize that you was wrong? Acknowledge the fact you never provided me a home, only taught me the strong survive. I didn't want to hear that shit when I was broken and crying, slowly dying, was so high, I thought I was flying. Mama, you know I ain't lying. When you look at me, what do you see? A child begging to be free. How remove these sins you bestowed upon me? I always thought you didn't give a fuck about me when you deliberately spit on me and sent me off with Arabs to get you money so you could party. You live your life through me when I was in a penitentiary. You somewhat act like you know me. Mama, you owe me. You owe only relations hold me.
Angelina, that must have been enormously difficult to write and share. But I imagine it was also very liberating for you.
Yes, yes, Tina, it was. Wow. You know, that particular piece that we just heard, I wrote it when I was 24. When I wrote that poem, it had absolutely nothing to do with her. It was all about me telling the world, this is where I come from, and this is the reason why I am. So by writing that poem, I was able to see myself for who I was, and not only say, okay, Mom, you know, you could have done a better job, but as well say, you know what, Angie, you was in a bad place in your life, so forgive yourself for the things that you didn't know. So now that I know better, I do better. And that poem freed me and gave me a better insight to why mothers and daughters have dysfunctional relationships and protect each other even when they know the other one is wrong.
What overarching messages are you trying to deliver? I mean, what do you want people to take from your poetry?
First of all, Tina, I want to tell you that I had no idea at the time when I wrote my poetry album that anyone would be interested or find any significance or relevancy to what I was talking about. So the most important thing that I want to convey to my audience is that self-expression is a powerful tool and a healthy method to dealing with everyday challenges we face in our life. So writing actually taught me empathy. It taught me how to have intimate relationships with people. It taught me how to relate to others and to put myself out of a situation and just feel what another person is going through. So my writing, I wrote only to share with myself. I had no idea that it would hold any relevancy today to anyone.
And then why did you choose this particular medium to share your life stories?
Yes, you know, Tina, that is a great question that you asked me. For me to answer that, I have to talk about politics. And to talk about politics, I will have to talk about black politics because I'm a black woman in America. And what I can tell you is that I totally can understand the reason why offenders reoffend. I can understand why the recidivism rate in America is so high, because even though I am a first-time felon, My felony is well over 10 years old. I have some college education as well as I'm certified and skilled in different areas. I'm unable to attain a job. So by sharing my poetry now, it gives me encouragement to go on. It somewhat validates my accomplishments and it gives me meaning in my life. I decided to share as well because it seems as if the things that I went through as a youth in the 90s, our children are going through now in the millennium. And in some way, because I've survived it, I believe that I figured out the answer to how to rid us of some of these young at-risk teens. So I'm sharing now simply as a vessel. I'm only a messenger that has a message.
Well, Angelina, any quick thoughts on what your vision is for your future?
Yes. You know what, Tina? I would love to be a community organizer. I created this program called Say Yes to Self-Expression. I would love to introduce it to another institution as a pilot program. I would love to do public speaking. I would love to get out in the community and really share my story and allow others to benefit and get encouraged and grow from what I went through. So, And just, you know, sky is the limit. God has been good to me. I've been delivered. I'm thankful. And I'm ready for whatever comes my way.
Well, Angelina, we hope that you get all of that and more too in your life. Thank you so much for sharing and speaking with us today.
Thank you, Tina. I truly appreciate the opportunity.
How do we talk about race in contemporary America? That's what 25-year-old poet and playwright Chinaka Hodge is trying to answer in her debut play, Mirrors in Every Corner. The play explores what happens to an African-American family in Oakland, California, after the mother gives birth to a Caucasian baby. As you would expect, an array of questions follow. Correspondent Emily Wilson spoke with Chinaka and some of her collaborators on the significance of exploring important personal and social issues through art.
I had a white baby. Had three black ones first. She's not light-skinned or pigment deficient or albino. She white. As rice or flour or other things that also come in brown.
That's from the beginning of Chinaka Hodge's debut play, Mirrors in Every Corner. The play was created out of questions Chinaka says she's been thinking about for a while.
The play is a series of arguments that I have with myself and I've been having with myself for as long as I can remember, and you know, kind of going back and forth with myself about ideas of what it means to create black family, what it means to preserve and maintain black family, what it means to love and a society that's calling itself post-racial.
The youngest daughter in the family is Miranda, but her family also calls her Random. Names are important in the play. They also include Ninth, as in amendment or ward, and Watts, like the tower or electricity. Chinaka says the character Random gave her a way to explore what race and family mean.
There's a lot there that kind of deals with what it means to unpack lineage and what it means to unpack historicity and legacy. And I think that, you know, Random kind of tackles all of that. And she's kind of the placeholder for anyone who's ever been confused about race or ever felt like an outsider, or ever felt like they didn't have all the answers. And I think that in a lot of ways, it's how our audience members come into the show as well. It's how anybody who's experienced race exists in the world. It's mostly from a place of questions, in my opinion, and definitely in my experience, that I don't have very many answers about race, but I have probing questions, lingering questions, haunting questions. And so I wanted to set up a place on stage where, you know, we could kind of have arguments with ourselves, and I could have arguments with myself.
The play is full of questions, as in this scene between Miranda's three siblings, Watts, Ninth, and Roe.
Because maybe if I know how it happened, I can understand her better.
What's to understand? She white. You said we win.
But she ain't really white, though.
Details.
Make a difference.
What
makes
her not white?
What makes you black?
History.
Politics. The way he's treated when he goes out.
Right.
So it's an issue of what other people think.
Nah, more about what you feel.
Always about feelings with you.
Feeling, touching,
thinking.
You know what? Why can't you just say what happened?
Chinaka's high school friend, David Diggs, plays the character Watts. Watts is the oldest brother in the family, and he's constantly trying to figure out his place in the world.
And I think the presence of a white sister in his midst, in the house, in with the family, sort of has his mind spinning about race for the rest of his life. So I think he brings up these questions a lot, and they just sort of keep coming, and they shift, you know, based on where he is intellectually in his development.
Chinaka thinks that audiences seem hungry to grapple with the questions the characters bring up about race. She tried to give people lots of ways to enter into the play. Rooting the story in a family was one way to do that.
I wasn't interested in making it easy for people to talk about race. I think that that's the worst way to start any kind of real dialogue, is to ease people into it. But I was interested in asking the questions that kind of resonate for me on a human level, and the questions that I can't answer by myself. And I think that's what people respond to more than anything else about the show is, you know, clearly people have been thinking about all these things. I'm not the first to think of it. I'm not the first to articulate these things. But I think it's palatable because it's a family that you're encountering, because the actor portrayals are so good and so human. And it's not a didactic piece. I don't say this is what you should think about race. It's more like, this is what I don't understand about race.
But Daddy hated her. Hated Random. Like, couldn't even be in the same room with her. Not to feed a bottle or change a diaper. And so the relief on his face when his T-cell count got low, it was just...
You have to be there. Here. And make the hard decisions and hold hands when it is inconvenient. If I have a brother and he is a murderer or a rapist or a Republican, my job, first and foremost, is to nurture and support. The irony about this black man loving his family is that he's going to have to love a white woman in the process, even if it is out of the simple desire to complicate the notion of what a black man is capable of. I can love my family.
In that scene we just heard, the character Ninth is talking with her brother Watts about how their father, who died of AIDS, couldn't love his white daughter Miranda. David is the oldest child in his family, like his character, Watts. David thinks Watts feels responsible for taking care of others.
And Watts, I think, sort of exemplifies this in that he's constantly trying to teach Miranda and trying to make sure that mom is okay and focused on becoming the new father figure after the father dies. But he never really talks about himself and his own problems and the ways that he's having trouble dealing with the father or with any other sorts of tragedy that happened over the course of the play.
Chinaka collaborated with other artists to create the show. The jazz trumpet score is by another high school friend, Ambrose Akamusir. There's a strong visual element to the play. Evan Bissell is the play's set designer. He also created a mural for the show. It consisted of paintings and photos of a real-life family in the Mission District, a Latino neighborhood in San Francisco. That's where the play was performed.
I wanted to do another part of the thing, jumping off of the ideas and the themes that Chinaka had brought up in the play, and connect it to the Mission, because the play is about West Oakland, but you know, a lot of the issues that the family's facing in West Oakland are very similar to issues that families are facing in the Mission District, so we wanted to connect that as well.
Chinaka was 14 when she started writing and performing. She says the Bay Area supports young people in telling stories, making music, and creating art of all kinds. Organizations like You Speaks, the Living Word Project, and Intersection for the Arts are places where local talent is nourished.
I think that folks our age are really itching to figure out the ways in which that we can take the art that's been kind of in our lineage and in our legacy for a bit and flip it so it makes sense for us. So I think, you know, we don't just write plays. You know, David and I, we write songs together. We write curriculum together. You know, Evan and I have collaborated on a number of projects where we chronicle the work of young people that we're interacting with. And so I think that, you know, I'm so humbled by, you know, all of the collaborators and the ways in which both Living Word and Intersection make a commitment to young artists.
Chinaka says she'll keep on writing poetry as well as plays and music. She may even try her hand at film and television. In the meantime, she says she'll continue to work with young people in the arts, giving back what she gained from her teachers and mentors. For Making Contact, I'm Emily Wilson, Oakland, California.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the US, Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. In this final segment, we hear from San Francisco-based indie film director Brian MacArthur, co-director of the film A Choice of Weapons. The film offers a view into the lives of two young people growing up in San Francisco's Bayview Hunters Point neighborhood. One character is on the road to nowhere. The other is beginning to understand herself and her community through a video camera lens. The film was made through Conscious Youth Media Crew, an organization that trains San Francisco's high-risk youth in digital media. These neighborhood kids wrote and directed the film. Correspondent Joaquin Palomino has more.
I'm here in the Making Contact studio with Brian MacArthur. He's the director of the feature-length film A Choice of Weapons. This movie was made with the help of the San Francisco-based youth media training program, Conscious Youth Media Crew. And first, I just want to say thanks for coming here, Brian.
No, thanks for having me.
This was a really ambitious project you guys undertook. First off, it's a full-length film, running at a little over 60 minutes. But what's even more impressive was that it was written and directed entirely by youth from San Francisco. Can you start by telling the audience what this movie's about?
The story is about D'Angelo King. He's like a little knucklehead, and he's growing up in the Bayview, which is located in San Francisco. And he's facing issues such as environmental racism, gang injunctions, evictions. He has a cousin named Ruby that's using digital media to tackle all the issues that are going on in the community. And actually, D'Angelo helps her in that fight.
We're going to hear a clip from the movie right now. And in this clip, we hear a bit of a conversation between D'Angelo and his cousin Ruby. D'Angelo's gone down a bad path. The movie starts out with him murdering somebody over a few dollars. He's being evicted. He has no job, and he just doesn't seem to care about his life. His cousin Ruby's trying to get him on the right path. She's trying to get him to see the bigger picture, see what's really going on around him in his neighborhood, and to get him involved. So here's the clip.
D, what are you, like, 20 years old? You don't work or go to school. So what are you doing with yourself?
I'm saying though, I'm not no sucker, and most definitely jobs is for suckers, yo. I got mad though.
Well, what about the eviction?
What about it?
You just really don't get it. D, it's bigger than that. It's bigger than just moving from house to house. Don't you see what's going on? All the construction? The new condos they building out here? Look around you. Don't you see? Ain't nothing but boarded up units up and down the streets.
So in this scene, you hit a very big issue that's facing the Bayview Hunters Point neighborhood. But also we see two characters interacting that represent very different elements of the community. How did you develop these two characters?
The characters were developed from real people, like friends, families. Just our experiences of living in Hunters Point, interacting with people that live in the community.
I mean, this movie feels really real, which maybe because it's really a movie about the Bayview Hunters Point neighborhood coming from people living in it. I guess a big question I have is, what was it like shooting on location there in the Bayview?
Me and the crew, we always said this one thing, and we kept saying, like, making the movie is more of a movie than actually filming the movie. There were times where we were in danger. There were times where we were just like out at sea, and we never thought we'd make it to land. It was very eye-opening. It was very educational, just seeing, like, you know, the information that we soaked up and the information that people that live in the community don't even really know about their own community soaked up.
Can you give me some? Do you have any concrete examples? Some stories?
There were times we were like in the middle of potential shootouts. You know, It's times like that where you're like, okay, I'm making a movie, but, you know, I gotta drop the camera before, you know, something happens.
Another technique that you guys used to make this movie feel so real was splicing documentary footage into the story, which flows so well because in the movie, first Ruby and then D'Angelo are working on a documentary. So in this scene, we're about to hear D'Angelo's hit rock bottom, and he realizes he doesn't want to keep living his life as a criminal. So he picks up his cousin Ruby's camera and he hits the streets. And here's the clip.
About the asbestos. Hell, I'm dying.
What happened? Tell me what's going on.
I have stomach cancer.
Yeah.
And I'm dying of asthma.
Yeah.
My name is Rosalind Y. Bell Whitfield. And I remember when all this was water out here.
Yeah. What you know about the evictions and stuff, though? Like?
The evictions? There's no such thing as evictions. They either kill you with pills, give you dope and drugs, or they just put your black ass out.
So why did you decide to make this movie this way, flowing in and out of documentary style and narrative film?
It wasn't more like we decided to make the movie that way. That's just how it was. Whether or not we decided to stage something, like the environment, it talked back to us, the community talked back to us. So that particular scene was unscripted. You know, we walked up to a lady in the community, we asked her a question, and she just spilled it all on us.
You're saying that that last scene wasn't scripted. You were just talking to people on the streets. How were they responding to you being there, making a movie about, you know, their lives, their neighborhood?
It was activism. Our character, D'Angelo, he actually went out there and he really physically got people to sign petitions to preserve the neighborhood. A lot of the times it wasn't making a movie. It was being a part of the fight. And the community embraced it. They loved us for that.
Tell you what, you do good in school, get good grades, graduate, make your mom proud, you can have this bike, yo.
Man, by then it's gonna be all messed up. I ain't gonna want it then. But I tell you what, you give me that camera and buy me a new bike, we cool.
This camera?
Yeah, man.
Yo, all right, it's a done deal. You be cool, how you be cool, baby, bruh. Stay off these streets, man. Do good in life. Represent for the people who couldn't, all right?
D'Angelo was passing a torch to the youngster. Just basically, you know, he's the next. You know, he has to document the future and tell the stories and be there. So people know about the community, so people know about what's really going on. And I think it's important that he says that to him at a young age, because, you know, what if D'Angelo had someone there, you know, when he was young, like, telling him to be on, like, on the right path? He probably would have been more like a Ruby.
All of you people who made this film are coming out of this youth media training program, the Conscious Youth Media Crew, which is about reaching out to at-risk youth and getting them connected and getting them involved using a video camera. And I was wondering how much of D'Angelo's story comes from your own experiences working with the Conscious Youth Media Crew.
Like, just for us, like, you really don't realize how much power you have, like, how much power your voice has until you actually get out there and do something, you know? It Conscious Youth, you know, created that platform for us to where we could voice our opinions. And for D'Angelo, the platform was created in the same way. And then once he started doing it, he started believing in it.
Like, what sort of stories do you want to share with people? What sort of messages do you want to get out with your video camera?
I like to, like, really dig into issues, like community issues, and find out what's really going on in the community from the people in the community, because each community has, like, a lot of history. Like, the Bayview has, you know, their own Rosa Parks, their own Martin Luther Kings, and if you don't keep your community, like, thriving, if you don't tell the stories of the community, like, it'll just be gone forever. Nobody will ever know about it.
You just heard correspondent Joaquin Palomino interviewing Brian MacArthur, co-director of the film A Choice of Weapons. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Or check out our website at radioproject.org to get our podcast, download past shows, or help make a difference by supporting our work. Making Contact is supported by listeners like you. You allow us to continue to offer our programming for free to radio stations across the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. Thank you. Lisa Redman is our executive director, Pauline Bartoloni, producer and online editor, Andrew Stelzer, producer, Con Fam Associate Director, Daphne Young Station Relations, Elena Daigle, Rashida Harmon, and Joaquin Palomino are interns. And I'm Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.